Welcome to The Historical Gadfly, a podcast devoted to history, current events, good books, and the connections between all three. I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, a graduate student at the University of Oxford. Our email address is historicalgadfly@gmail.com. If you have any questions or suggestions or ideas for future episodes, we'll be glad to hear them. And as always, thanks for tuning in.
Where myself and Tim Noonan will be discussing Daniel Rosenberg and Anthony Grafton's book, Cartographies of Time, A History of the Timeline. And we'll be just discussing a few points of debate, things we found interesting or didn't entirely agree with one another on. And I guess I'll give it to Tim now.
Yeah, thanks, John. I'm really excited to join you to kind of wrap up what I think has been a really interesting discussion of this book. We've just been posting blog posts on Tandem Reading, tandemreading.blogspot.com, for the last couple of weeks. And, yeah, just to kind of close out the discussion, having a conversation of maybe 40 or 50 minutes about what the major themes of the book were, some of our favorite diagrams. This book has fantastic graphics in it. And to kind of try to situate this book in the larger picture of where historical scholarship today is going. But before we jump into the kind of meat of the discussion, I think it might be wise to say a few words about ourselves or, you know, why we're qualified or why we're probably completely unqualified to be talking about this sort of book. So why don't you go ahead first, John?
Well, we're probably unqualified, but that should still be fun to talk about. If you're reading this blog, you're most likely a friend of one of ours. But,
right. We have marketing is not... Yeah, I'm sure, like, the blog, blog probably has, like, three total unique readers, two of which are John and I, so, and third is probably John's grandmother, so.
There will someday be a timeline of publicity for this, but I have a degree in English from Princeton University and Oxford University, but my interests are really turning more and more towards history, particularly intellectual history of the sort that I believe this book exemplifies in so many ways in terms of range and, just an ability to track themes over a wide period of time across countries, with an especial focus in many parts of the book on Anglophone intellectual history. And with that, Tim?
Yeah, my name is Tim Noonan. I also went to Princeton, like John, where I studied German there mostly. And basically kind of been a historian or kind of an intellectual historian in some ways for the last couple of years. I focused mostly on 20th century German history while I was at Princeton, but since then have gone over more to Russian, both the language as well as the literature and especially history, and especially the 20th century, so Soviet Union stuff. And right now I'm studying for a master's degree in history at Oxford with stints in such charming places as Berlin, Moscow, Tajikistan, Turkey, and elsewhere in between, and, you know, trying to figure out what I'm doing with myself, but enjoying discussing history all the way. So maybe, I don't know, I've perhaps done more of the training to be qualified, to be considered a historian, not that that means anything in this world, or certainly that it gets you any better job prospects or so on, but...
I'm offended, Tim, but...
Well, that's what we aim for always. So why don't we just start off for readers who maybe haven't had the time to look at the blog very much or who aren't that familiar with the book or are thinking of, you know, getting it from the library or possibly purchasing it. What is this book about?
Would you like to begin, Tim, or shall I?
Well, I thought the dramatic pause was impetus. Well, you know, the book is, what's the book the subtitle? The book is subtitled A History of the Timeline, which kind of tells you where it's going. And when I've asked people about timelines, I think I got a lot of weird looks around Oxford this past week. I'd be going around, you know, meeting people and thinking as a conversational icebreaker, I'd ask them, oh, what's your favorite timeline? Or, you know, if you had to think of a timeline of the last day or the last 5 minutes, what would it have been like? Needless to say, a lot of these responses said, oh, everything was going great until I met this guy like 10 seconds ago who asked me these bizarre questions, and I started just getting really uncomfortable with him. But, you know, the main thing was many people, when asked this question, they tend to assume that the timeline is this default form for representing events in history. I think we just take it for granted that putting a geometric line down, typically running from left to right on a page, and then, you know, plopping crosshatches in it and saying, this is when I was born, this is when I got married, this is when I bought a house, and so on. All of that, we think of that as just an intuitive way, a natural way, perhaps, of representing time. And part of what Grafton and Rosenberg are trying to do in this book is to show, first off, that this just isn't true, that the timeline as we know it is actually a relatively recent invention, but also to put that picture of the timeline that we know so well today and then show where it came from and how people before around 1700 or 1800, you know, represented time. And it was, of course, very important. And so how did they do it, actually, before timelines? What were, I mean, just as you remember it, John, or how would you put it as how Greeks or medieval historians and so on represented the passage of time?
Well, I'm not sure about the classical heritage entirely, Tim, but part of what I think Rosenberg and Grafton very eloquently show throughout their book was how it grew out of different tables, which medieval historians like Eusebius, amongst others, would organize information, where there wasn't exactly any notion of causality at that point, but it was an organization, some sense of illustrating the passage of time in such a way that you could harness all of these sort of events, authors, different time schemes, biblical, secular, and otherwise, into some sort of a coherent whole. And to kind of complement what you said, Tim, in terms of asking people about the timeline, which I've done not quite so thoroughly as you have, perhaps.
Gotten several restraining orders taken out on me and spent an evening in the Oxford jail. It's not a great pickup line for ladies.
I wired over bail, just in case. But with the timeline, I know when I was coming to this book at first, I thought of the timeline as very much a medium of choice that could organize information in a way that conceivably could be organized in other ways, and that there wasn't precisely a direct insight or a sort of insight that timelines offered over, say, those same tables, that of Eusebius or even some of the medieval chronicles where it was date, event, date, event, and so on.
Right.
So Grafton and Rosenberg never entirely state a strong central thesis, as I believe I discussed in one of my posts, but the idea that a certain kind of information, or recognition, we might say, or appreciation, grows out of a timeline that is not offered in other ways. And of course, with this also goes different questions of value, neutrality, which I believe you've touched on, Tim. Mm-hmm. But it's not exactly, a reversible sort of operation, or, as Grafton and Rosenberg show, one that just kind of happened out of nowhere.
Right, and when we're talking about this central thesis, you know, I think I basically agree with you that, I mean, this is kind of a strange genre of book, isn't it? I mean, it's sophisticated, certainly, but it's also this kind of very, you know, this is almost the kind of book I would expect to find at, like, the apartment of a professor at Columbia, you know, as the coffee table book for, like, you know, a New York intellectual or something like that. But, you know, I don't think this is the kind of book. It is very much, I think, like a coffee table thing, but, you know, if you show up to Grandma's house in Indiana or something, you're not going to find this next to, like, Birds of America or whatever. But in terms of what is the argument of the book, you know, I think at moments the book may risk going into this mode of walking through the museum. Here's this really pretty picture on the right. Here's this really pretty picture on the left with some commentary, but maybe not having the strong thesis that someone who's more inclined towards like academic historical scholarship might be looking for. But go ahead.
Also, Tim, if you just look at the book sitting on a table, if you thought of a genre, so to speak.
Yeah.
It would be almost a popular reading, or kind of in that strange hinterland of popular history, almost academic, or academic despite itself in a sense, almost kind of luring the reader in. So I know it wasn't my experience, but amongst others who picked up Anthony Grafton's book, The Footnote, were just terrified to find real footnotes on the very first page. Mm. saying, oh my god, this is very hard scholarship.
Yeah, you know, I think with this, just right before we talked, I was sort of thinking about this topic, and I did, you know, some very, very rigorous research, which consisted of looking at the Amazon sales rankings for both this book as well as some other, you know, history books, just to get a sense of, is there any correlation between formatting or subject matter and sales? And it was interesting. So here are sort of, I'll give three or four examples. So Amazon does this thing where, you know, the top-selling book has the rank of one and then downwards. So this book, Cartographies of Time, had a total ranking of 31,537. Now, do you think that would... What does your gut tell you? Do you think that would be good or bad for a history book? Like, the average good thing produced by a scholarly press, is that going to be significantly lower, significantly higher, about the same? What's your intuition for that?
Well, I would say any history book that doesn't aim at a niche kind of audience, so Civil War reenactors, you know, probably push along several university presses, or kind of World War II buffs, which is, in an odd sense, almost a popularly accepted sort of reading group.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, you know, you don't have to be a scholar or anything else, per se, to read about World War II. And perhaps that has connections with one's own parents' experience.
Yes.
And so forth.
Yeah.
I would also just note, Tim, that Amazon rankings, of course, change over time.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining this book was actually probably a good deal higher right after the New York Times review, a few others, and especially around holiday times. Because,
yeah,
like you said, this is a beautiful kind of coffee table gift book, in a sense.
Yes. I made sure to, you know, compare, just, you know, to give some perspective, the book The Ascent of Money by the Harvard historian Neil Ferguson, which I think can be found at your friendly local neighborhood Costco, that had a rank of 6,558.
Wow.
It was published relatively recently. And then for some comparison, there's a book that's probably more specialized, but I remember seeing this at the Borders, which is now bankrupt, at Union Station in Washington, D.C. in December, a book called The Last Utopia by Samuel Moyne, who's a historian at Columbia. It's a history of human rights in the 20th century. That book, which came out, again, like last fall, had a ranking of 11,789. So
it might have something to do with paperback editions as well.
Yeah, that's very true, I'm sure. But,
and also it's Union Square, Tim. Come on.
Yeah, although just for comparison, for the scale, different scales we're talking about, I looked up the numbers for this book called Spies in Arabia by Priya Satya, which is a book about World War I in Iraq and Mesopotamia. And this is a book that won, like, maybe the most prestigious prize you can win for a history book, the Herbert Baxter Adams Prize. And it had a... You want to guess, you know, what its ranking was?
I'll just take a stab and say 50,000.
312,924.
Hmm.
So... But I think this is like interesting, and we should return, I think, to the main content of the book, but maybe at the end we can come full circle and talk about what is the style of history being presented here, and is there a problem with the specialized study if just nobody is reading it? Like, what are the, you know, you don't want to have everybody trying to produce the coffee table book, just as you don't want to have everybody trying to produce the specialized monograph. There are different career arcs, different times in one's career when one produces a more specialized work. But I definitely thought about this a lot as someone who's currently writing a dissertation, thinking maybe towards doctoral study in history, to think of, okay, well, you know, do I really actually want to spend all of my time writing this, you know, these bizarre specific case studies of places that, like, nobody's ever heard of?
Well, there's a reason tomb and tome are almost homophones, aren't there, Tim?
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, bad joke.
But
we got it. We have our pun out of the way.
Okay, great. Like, yeah, John said something to embarrass himself. We're only, I think, 13 or 14 minutes in, so hold on to your...
Excellent.
Hang on to your...
Excellent.
But, I mean, to get back to the central theme of this book, one thing that I think ran through for me, this came up relatively early in the book when they were talking about the Italian humanist Giambattista Vico, one thing they mentioned was with the early models of chronology, when these Greek and Roman historians were involved in it, this was something that was very distinct from history. In other words, this was not writing narrative prose and giving your analysis of events, or was Caesar a good ruler, or was, you know, Remo a bad cook, or whatever. It was, as you mentioned earlier, very much about fixing precise dates, and many times the notion of causality was not present at all. Subsequently, this led to a situation where, after the Greek and Roman empires had collapsed, by the beginning of the Renaissance, when people were beginning to consider, okay, was Rome just the end of human civilization as we know it? Is there some way we can rise again and create our own new thing that is taking up the tradition but also like reinventing it? Vico was this guy who began to become more interested in like narrative history and history as opposed to chronology. He felt that this method of just listing dates and eventually coming to the collapse of Rome and then these 600 years of relative darkness, or however they perceived it as the time, this emphasized a model of history that was basically about decline, whereas Vico, I think, was more interested in a kind of history that would actually analyze, say, the Iliad, and for him, at least, come to the conclusion that, well, hey, this was an oral text written for a largely illiterate population, and sure, we still have peasants starving in the Italian countryside or what have you, but we produced Dante, and Dante is like maybe more impressive as a literary product, and beginning to emphasize the ascent of civilization rather than decline. And I think somehow Vico thought this mode of history as chronology was more declinist than ascendist, to invent a word. And that was sort of one theme I thought was, are you going to portray history as moving up from Rome, or as just Rome as the peak and then the decline? And of course, this, you know, chronology stuff was usually important for models of Christian history. It became, as we discussed in some of the examples, usually important for revolutionaries when they wanted to emphasize that they were doing something new that broke with tradition, and so on. So I think this tension between decline and rise, and how does my mode of writing history imply one vision or the other, was a big theme in the book.
Well, to kind of go along with that, then, just some quick thoughts. Part of this has to do with calendars as well. So when you mentioned a revolutionary sort of push to reestablish time in some sense, of course, I'm thinking of the calendars in the French Revolution.
Sure.
A character I certainly want to ask you about later on in the 20th century would be Spengler. And, of course, at the moment, I'm still reading, Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Just for context, this is a book that you started reading, what, like, almost a year ago? Or
About 2 years ago.
Okay.
On and off. I think something, if I can kind of continue with this, and I would agree with you, is that, to some degree, decline, yes, but there's also a sense of working with more information that I think kind of complicates that to an extent. So if you ask me what was perhaps the most interesting early example that Rosenberg and Anthony Grafton offer, it would be Ubo Emius's Chronology. It's on page 76, if you have a book, where pages will go by that simply don't have anything. There's just no information to work with. And in a certain sense, there's a humility of understanding that we're coming from an earlier age. We have different cultural values moving up, so to speak, to that point of decline before we kind of retreat from it. So I don't think you can quite so cleanly say that it's all a kind of declining mode. There are different kinds of declining, or decadence. So literary figures will become kind of more prominent. There's more bad poetry, say, or more records of sort of second cities besides Rome and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with you, Tim, but I think there's kind of tweaks. And I think some of the beauty of the more complicated timelines is they don't just kind of track one line of thought. It's not simply political. It's not simply religious. I think one of the strengths of it is that, especially as time goes on, the timeline grows to include more and more information. So it can track a decline as it's also recording an ascent, so to speak, in some other field or line of thought.
Yeah, and another thing that was very interesting with Emius's chronology was, I think he may have been one of the first to employ what you might call time compression or time expansion into the image itself, or into the timeline itself. In other words, he made multiple versions of the same charts where, you know, in one of them, one would be 5 inches long and another would be 3 feet long, and it wouldn't always, the spacing wouldn't necessarily be uniform. Like on one chart, the history of Rome might represent a foot and a half, and then you have 3 inches of blank space for the next 800 years, and then you get another, you know, foot and a half for, you know, let's say history post 1300 or so. So there's this sense that as an image maker, you could stretch out the quantity of time and, you know, these creative visual representations for, okay, how much stuff actually happened here? Are we going to squeeze it in? How do I want to emphasize, you know, how do I want to emphasize, man, this was really a doldrum of a century. Nothing happened at all. Versus, okay, this just isn't important, and we're just skipping it for now.
And of course, those spaces and kind of ellipses, lacuna, could speak very eloquently as well, in terms of, we don't have any information, we don't know what happened. I'm thinking more kind of towards the early Middle Ages or the Dark Ages.
Yes, and then, well, and just speaking about, getting back to your point about how it wasn't always going to be necessarily about political history, some of the most striking timelines here, you know, it's hard to describe this, but I think, you know, when I'm describing the situation in which Tim approaches random women on the street, asks them about timeline, and then gets thrown into jail, that's usually just one person's experience of the day or something. It's not multi-civilizational, and it's not covering, like, okay, what was the day like in Istanbul versus in Islamabad versus Tokyo or something. And whereas many of these really innovative timelines, I'm looking here at page 114 and 115, this thing called A Chart of Universal History by Thomas Jeffries, this great image where horizontally it's covering almost the entire world with places like Spain, France, Germany, Italy, Persia, Tartary, the Indies, North and South America, and the vertical axis represents time. So starting at the top is like zero, and then the bottom is the present. And so you get this really interesting visual representation that's more complex than the caricature I gave of Vico's vision of history, where it's not just, you know, you have this point in history where the Roman Empire stretches across maybe two-thirds of the page, or two-thirds of the entire chart, but then eventually it starts to disintegrate, and it becomes the Caliphs of Andalusia when you're looking at the Spain column, elsewhere when you're looking at Persia, or parts of what he calls Turkey in Asia. The Eastern Empire eventually becomes the Empire of the Caliphs and Arabs, or the Saracens. And then, of course, the part that remains is Constantinople, and Byzantine Empire eventually becomes the Empire of the Ottoman Turks. So here there's a more complicated model of disintegration, but because it's not just about are we Rome or not Rome, but rather are we Rome or, well, hey, maybe there's a Turkish or Turkic tradition of what Constantinople can be, or maybe there's an Arab tradition, and it doesn't mean just destruction of Rome, but it also means rise of Arab civilization, rise of Turkic, rise of Persian civilization, and so on. And that, you know, so just to complicate another vision, different from what we were talking about with Vico a couple minutes ago.
And of course, even when precise dates aren't known, to kind of get back a little bit to that idea of chronology and history, you can never entirely escape chronology, I think, with history, especially if you're trying to do that sort of Vico notion of a larger analysis. Causality is important. You can't escape it to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And here in this map, looking at it myself, it is relatively accurate, it seems to me, Tim, or at least attempting to be so, in terms of sort of delineating exactly when things happened, when things kind of went down the drain with, say, Constantinople.
Yeah.
The very kind of large column that it inhabits eventually dwindles down to just the city itself, mm-hmm. before it's subsumed into the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, yes. So maybe to transition to even less serious or more whimsical topics. This is just a fantastic book to hold in your hands and just flip through, isn't it? I mean, with all the great images and so on. And you know, as we were doing the blog posts, I think both of us had to probably resist the temptation many times to include more images than we did, just because there's a lot of just completely ridiculous items in here, and some of these are scaled down version of charts that in real life were like 10 feet tall and 3 feet wide.
I don't know if you had the experience, Tim, but there were quite a few I wanted to include in my blog post that I simply couldn't find online. even in kind of a rougher kind of version. So that's another plug for people to actually check the book out of a library or buy it. Tim and I could only really kind of hint at some of the things to be found in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of the materials coming from here, you have some stuff that's publicly available. For example, I think in John's post around about some of the more recent ways that architecture has used chronology, you have stuff like Maya Lin's Woman's Table at the Yale campus in New Haven. You have the memorial to the Oklahoma City bombings, which plays around with the time that the bombings took place. But, you know, certainly a lot of this stuff from antiquity, a lot of these materials are coming from research libraries or special collections around the world, so you're simply unlikely to be able to find the kind of stuff that you're talking about here.
And to return to something Tim said a little earlier, I think, just to add to that, one of my slight frustrations with the book was that, as lovely as some of these examples are, at times those in Bergengraf and skip over a little bit, actually explaining how they work. Mm-hmm. So at times there will be a very complicated chart that receives maybe a paragraph at most. And at times readers will have to work to relate that chart to the principles of earlier charts in terms of how they function. But, well, Tim, I'd like to know, hear from you. Were there a few charts that you actually couldn't entirely figure out reading the book?
You know, I'm looking around and then I'm trying to, here, I'm just looking on around page, one of my favorite charts in this book was the Polish system, which is very hard to describe in words. But there's on page 204, there's a chart that's very similar to what the Polish system was. Maybe we should explain what the Polish system was first. You know, I'm looking around, and there that was kind of a problem. I mean, I'm sort of jumping around a lot now, but one chart that I think was a little difficult to understand and that I could have used more explanation of was, so basically in the early 20th century, when telegraph lines were just being installed across the Atlantic, we have telegraph lines going from one place to another, but just before that, one way to get messages from Europe to America was sending stuff from ship to ship with, you know, aerial-based telegraph signals, from, like, the Titanic to another ship to another ship. And you'd have these big charts that the telegraph companies developed where it would, you know, it's complicated to describe, but it would be one ship is leaving, say, New York on a given day, and then we know that it's going to arrive in Shannon, Ireland the next day, and then it's going to get to Copenhagen and then get to Bremerhaven and then turn around and so on. But you have this huge, huge chart of intersecting diagonal lines that's representing both time as well as geography, as well as the name of the ship, and you're supposed to find where the intersection is between these two diagonal lines of various ships to know when you're supposed to pass the message from the one ship to the other. And, you know, if you look at these charts for 5 or 10 minutes, you can make them out, but I think probably, you know, I think for a popular reader, you can get a little bit overwhelmed by these things just because they're, you know, they're quite inherently complex in themselves, and I think there can be a tendency to devote only maybe a paragraph of some, you know, probably 200 words or 100 words to individual charts, and sometimes I think that leads to a little bit of a scattered feel to the book, in spite of the fact that you do get all these fantastic images with it.
I would agree with you, Tim, and with that example in particular, it's a chart very much that rewards the person who is looking for a particular piece of information,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, as readers, we're not always approaching these with that sort of agenda in mind, or design, certainly. One map I know that certainly rather confused me, if you want to look at it, Tim,
mm-hmm.
is the historical chart published by Girolamo Andrea Martignoni
mm-hmm.
in 1721. That's pages 110 to 111. If I can take a crack at explaining this, it represents time almost in terms of geographical size and placement. So it's a map that, to all intents and purposes, to my eye, looks like a severely distorted sort of Mercator map, almost. But the visual analogy, I think, is just so simply kind of complex and idiosyncratic that if you're not entirely keyed into it, or if you're not staring at it for a half an hour or so...
Right, I mean, just to tell listeners more about this, I mean, this thing is pretty ridiculous, where... On the bottom, you have probably something like, I would estimate around 100 different crests of different what looked to be duchies or princedoms in Europe. And, you know, this thing is still zoomed out really far, so there's probably a lot of detailing missing even in that discussion of it.
I think it might offer a key on the right that, frankly, I didn't even notice before. Or some sort of collection of coins. There's an odd map of Europe kind of in the way I was suggesting.
Right.
Yeah.
On the right, I think that might be a that might be a legend to the, you know, what this looks like is, it seems almost like a legitimating device for the Holy Roman Empire as sort of successor to Rome in it, is what I would guess, because I'm just trying to look here. Well, yeah, because it ends, you see, the big river ends flowing with Dominio Austriaco, which I presume is probably the Habsburg dynasty, and then eventually flowing down, and you can see that one of the crowns, one of those crests at the bottom is more emphasized than the other ones. But yeah, basically the way this is working is on the left-hand side you have Italy emphasized with major families or major royal houses in Italy, it appears like, and then in Germany. But needless to say, once you get to like the 12th century Holy Roman Empire, you have 30 or 40 different families that are all vying for claim to the crown, and it just gets very, very complicated. Needless to say, talking about Holy Roman Empire politics in the 13th century, I mean, you know, my God, it's like, just, hello. But still, you know, an interesting design, but still, you know, underlines how complicated the thing is without actually lending any new clarity to it, I think.
Well, there can be a sort of a value in some sense of capturing that notion of almost information overload, or just it's so complex that immediately approaching this map, you know that you're going to have to dedicate a certain amount of time and effort to it. Whether that's more valuable than actually finding the map accessible and using it, even in some sort of a polemical sense, I suppose is pretty debatable.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here, ultimately for me, is just how much it... I mean, to me, this is almost a map about, or a timeline about, what is the basis for legitimate sovereignty. And I think the answer is ultimately Roman law or Roman institutions. And there's this need to, even by 1700 or 1721, when this map was published, to still ground the legitimacy of sovereign rule in, you know, like northern Germany. In some institution that was founded in the first century, this view could be completely wrong. Like, I'm not a historian of Holy Roman Empire.
Maybe the map's point is you shouldn't look so closely at it. Just take your word. It's Roman.
Right. Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, one thing we didn't focus on so much in the book was who are the target audiences for some of these things. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, I hesitate that a 18th century peasant is going to be reading one of these things, certainly. But I have to imagine, well, for this kind of thing, I suspect it's probably used to justify a certain royal family, not royal families, but ducal or princely families' claim to ties with the Holy Roman Empire or a certain tie of blood, and used to justify legitimacy. But not a ton of focus on audience reception, although the book is already about 300 pages long, so...
Well, I might disagree with you a little bit on that, Tim, where I think this is a point that we've kind of legitimately tussled on a little bit in the blog, is that later on in the book, it does kind of shift to an audience sort of focus in terms of getting out of academia, or getting out of trained genealogists, or chronologists, or historians. There were examples later on, I think in the chapter that bothered you the most, of the use put towards, the timeline was put towards in the frontier period of America. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples I really enjoyed, and I wish there had been more of, maybe even, I dare say, more sophisticated examples, was the sticks that could be, wooden sticks that could be carven with a sort of capsule history of the church towards the present day. And there was sort of a competition between Protestant and Catholic missionaries in terms of how do you sort of account for the other. Are you a branch, kind of a new branch growing from a rotten tree for the Protestants, or was Protestantism just sort of this, like, weird outgrowth that you should sort of ignore.
Right, I'm looking here in particular on page 154 and 155 of the book. There's a document, or a timeline from 1840 called Catholic Ladder, which was designed by a French-Canadian Catholic priest named Francois Norbert Blanchet. And yeah, I mean, it starts off, let's see, where does this thing even start off? It starts off with the creation, the bottom starts off with the creation. Going up, you have some of these very abstract symbols for the Tower of Babel. It looks like various biblical families. Finally, you have this dramatic scene that really spreads across the full canvas of the crucifixion. But then, finally, let's see, you go down even more, and I'm just looking on this chart for how they depict the split. Three vertical bars indicating the Protestant Reformation. One is for Luther, one is for Calvin, and the other is for Henry VIII.
And then it's also quite literally a branch diverging from a central line, some sort of a metaphor of a central, almost succession.
Yeah, but I think it's also important to emphasize with this that the branch, I mean, in relation to the total, like, length of the chart, the branch is, you know, it's just not very big. Like, it's clear here that Protestantism is not a legitimate side institution of Catholicism whatsoever, and it just kind of tapers out, and we don't have any discussion of, well, I don't see any discussion of, even though it was Catholic, I don't see any discussion of Jansenism here, Well, we discussed some of these things with Gibbon, like Socinianism, I believe, a lot of the other trends of Protestant reform currents at the time. This is really primarily a story about the history of the Catholic Church as a successor church to Christ, which was itself a successor like institution to the Jewish Church. And Protestantism here is just frankly not an important element.
Well, we could also discuss Trinitarianism for about a half an hour, Tim. But just to maybe wrap up this point, is that the Protestant alternative, located on page 156, more or less allows the Catholic kind of timeline, so to speak, to incriminate itself, where the ultimate point is a pope being flipped upside down into a pit of fire and devils. And you know, thank God our timeline is boring. You know, we don't have all these kind of incidences of corruption and everything else. But what's perhaps most interesting about it is that the Protestant model has a timeline right from the beginning that's separate from the Catholic Church, even though there are kind of connections that they put, most prominently the crucifixion scene.
Yes, but here Paul is depicted very prominently as a Protestant theologian or founder of the Church. And Moses, so as is Moses, Cain and Abel are closer to that side. But on the left side, with the Catholics, you have Adam and Eve, you have Babel, you have something I can't read, you have a gentleman giving a woman someone's head on a silver platter, and so on and so forth, just going through. But, yeah, I mean, the Protestant side is essentially after Jesus comes to earth, you have, like, 10 centuries of peace and bliss, and then Luther shows up. And that's it. So again, here, there's no emphasis on the Anglican side of things. There's no emphasis on Calvinism. Luther is presented as the legitimate spokesman or the legitimate theorist or theologian of this belief system.
Now, to kind of get away a little bit from this, because I think you've more or less wrapped it up, Tim, can I ask if you had a favorite chart?
You know, I think...
Or timeline.
I think probably, you know, I go back and forth. There is this Polish system that I enjoyed a lot, but I think I'd probably go to the very beginning of the book, actually. Just at some of the cartoons by Saul Steinberg, the great cartoonist.
He's excellent, yeah.
Yeah. There's one at the beginning. Let's see what page this is on. There's this one that's a timeline of the United States history. It's on one of the very first pages. Let's see. Here it is. It's on page 11, the first diagram in the book.
Also, for people following along, I chose this graphic for my very first post on the book.
Yeah. And, I mean, I just think this one is very charming and just really funny. It's basically a timeline of basically United States history from 1932 until 1970. And you start off by building this large edifice out of 1932, 1933, and so on. And you build all the way up on this magnificent thing, and then you hit 1952, which I'm taking to be, you know, kind of maybe a betrayal of the potential intellectual or the ultimate current liberal politics of Stevenson. Then you have this huge plunge with 53. And then they're basically stuck underground, digging these holes in this little ant farm thing that you can't escape out of. 1954 is a false route, so is 55, you're going in the right direction. 56, you make this huge hole and have to turn around, and so on and so forth. And it's only until 1961 again that you get to the Promised Land. But then you start building up and up and up again. Interestingly, there's no mention of 63 or the Kennedy assassination here. 67 is getting kind of crazy. It's this little slug-shaped thing balanced on top of a circle formed in 1962 to 1966. And then you start building up and up and up higher until you get to 1970 when the chart ends. And you have this kind of just scrubbed outlook to it. I'm not entirely sure what to make of the whole chart, but I think I really love it because it there's so much verve to it. I think it captures a lot of the serendipity and a lot of the back and forthness of, oh my God, this is a great year, political euphoria, and then just being totally out in the wilderness, which is how I interpret the 53 to 61 thing here in this chart. But
well, yeah, I think just after that, Tim, I think one of the principles that's not being stated here would be, of course, as you kind of hinted, presidential elections.
Yeah, not even, and it's interesting because you have 52 as this great moment, 61 you're out of the ground, but it's really, I mean, the bookends of the Eisenhower administration, these two big elections that are seen as the failures. And, you know, the whole thing starts with 32, with, of course, FDR's election. And things are basically, the only exception, which I didn't actually notice this until we looked at this closely, but if you look at 1949, part of this edifice on the left, the sort of floor has cracked. And I wonder what that is. I mean, I'm trying to remember when precisely the Korean War was. In our discussion about chronology, but I'm not totally sure where that fits into the whole scheme of things. But you really have this edifice that represents the FDR Truman years, then wilderness years, and then the 60s are basically funky. You know, you have like this circle that represents maybe kind of the relative calmness of the early 60s, but then once you get past 66, it's just really crazy and unbalanced, and you just don't know where you're going. And it looks like this thing is about to topple over circa 1970 when we finish it. And this thing is just clearly unbalanced in a way that the New Deal brain of liberalism was not. I mean, it ended in 52 and you have this plummet, but the whole structure itself is not about to collapse in the same way that 60s liberalism is going to do so, apparently.
So, of course, this is a model of decline. And to evoke some of the terms that Grafton and Rosenberg use, it expresses information in such a way that just the kind of recitation of just dates and events and, say, even the tallies of presidential votes wouldn't really suggest.
Yes.
How about you?
What would you say was your favorite timeline from the book?
Well, it's probably not quite as interesting as yours, Tim, to be frankly honest, but it would be Priestley's kind of grand chart of biography. On pages 118 to 119, where for the first time I sort of felt, I'll be honest, the Steinberg one didn't really entirely strike me so thoroughly until pretty much just now. But with this chart, which, if I can describe it, I suppose, runs along vertical axes, measure out the time, the date, in segments of 100 years. And it tracks, using a length of a line running horizontally, the lifespan of different very significant figures in, let's see, statesmen and warriors. That's one group, and it's actually pretty much the most populous. Divines and metaphysicians, men mathematicians and physicians, men artists and poets, men orators and critics, and then finally, historians, antiquaries, and lawyers. Where, going back from the earliest time to the present moment, basically there are more significant figures to record. And very eloquently, there are grand spaces where there's just one or two people worthy of mention, and then suddenly there's an explosion, more or less dating to
1500.
The 16th century.
Yeah.
And for me, this was really the first kind of experience of a chart that sense of frequency or a kind of cultural explosion that I don't think I would have really seen or recognized in any other form.
And it's interesting to emphasize with this chart when you talk about the explosion. I mean, I think this chart for me gives me a really strong sense of how Well, Priestley was doing this in 1765, so granted about 250 years after the event. But still, the sense of rebirth, finally we have a new tradition, or we found a way to reinvent the tradition, and we're not just overcome by it, circa 1500. And it's important to note, I think, that what we're saying is true primarily for all of the categories except for divines and metaphysicians and statesmen and warriors. So this rebirth, the new tradition, or the reinvented tradition, is really one that's carried by sciences, the arts, law, and people writing prose, basically. Whereas when you're talking about religion, philosophy, or politics or war, those are basically constants of human life. With some, you know, there are some lulls in it, but we're getting a view that in some ways we're building on an older tradition because mathematicians did exist in the past, and yes, we are continuing some of their progress. And what might be interesting here is, you know, you talk about how the horizontal lines reflecting the lifetimes of these intellectuals are done. I mean, many times they're on the same line, and it appears, like, let's see if we can find someone that we recognize. Well, right, so Chaucer is represented on the same line as Priester, Mandic, Otway, and Swift. And, you know, I don't know enough about the authors to make me claim about the similarity between Chaucer's work and Swift's work, but I think it's just interesting how Priestley created this graphic schematic where he put himself in a position to make these kinds of comparisons and say that Swift was perhaps in some way the inheritor of a Chaucerian tradition or was reinventing what Chaucer did with poetry or prose.
Oh, absolutely. And along with this, if anybody can find this image up on the internet, there's almost a sense of a broken continuity
mm-hmm.
without betraying, I think, the actual dates as they are known, which is just another example for me of the chart actually expressing or holding something that wouldn't otherwise be apparent.
Absolutely. So I guess, I mean, maybe to bring this discussion to a close and hopefully not to lower the tone too much, I mean, I guess, first off, right. So, I mean, what do you think you would have done differently if you were authoring this book? And then, what are some of the reflections on just your everyday world or life in America today, or you know, current politics or so on that you think, you know, what can we learn from timelines to like help understand the world around us better, essentially?
Well, there's certainly an idea of sort of locating an origin in the past for the present moment, which we touched on a bit. Like I said before, I really liked your notion, Tim, of sort of a skip period, especially with the 20th century, with fascism and totalitarianism, in terms of erasing periods from consciousness and that being okay in some sense. Mm-hmm. And of course it isn't. That's kind of the point of timelines, I think, or at least kind of the more honest ones. So, I mean, you asked quite a bit there, Tim. Would you like to take over for a bit?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to turn this into an overtly political podcast or anything. I mean, far from it. But, you know, I think in one of the early posts, I think your friend Donald responded to one of my posts. We're having kind of an interesting discussion on how the different sides of the political spectrum in America today, which, by the way, doesn't have just two sides, how the different parts of it view American history and which sections in history are emphasized or which history become these sections that just didn't happen at all. I was thinking about this a little and kind of spent some time, you know, amusing myself by drawing different charts of U.S. history in the 20th century based on how someone like Glenn Beck looks at it versus how maybe liberal academics look at it today. There's been a lot of work recently on how there was a so-called golden age of capitalism between maybe 1950 and 1975 or so, that you hear a lot from people like Paul Krugman. There's a book by Jacob Hacker that just came out called Winner Take All Politics that, you know, extends this more and views 1975 to 2010 essentially as a real decline. But anyway, you know, you look at this and, you know, I think if you're looking at the right in America today, we have this strange notion of time where it seems like everything until approximately 1900 and still until when McKinley was assassinated and TR came into office of being a good time of innovation, economic expansion, and so on. And then with the...
Everything before an income tax, in other words, but...
and the establishment of the... I mean, it's coherent in a certain kind of way. I mean, there's the establishment of the income tax, which I think was 1911, There's the establishment of the Fed, which I think was 1912 or 1913, and then obviously the U.S. intervention into World War One under Wilson and liberal internationalism. And needless to say, people like Glenn Beck or Ron Paul or John Boehner occupy very different positions in the American right today. But, you know, if you take opposition to the Fed, lower taxes or get rid of the income tax, and, you know, limited American role in the world, that's, like, basically the platform of Ron Paul today. So I think, you know, I don't want to try to over-intellectualize this too much, but I think that there is this, there are these notions of mistakes or missed periods in American history that politicians draw on. And on, you're looking at this on the left now. There you have, I think, this idea that 1932 to basically 1975 is a golden age. Liberals, I think, have tended to reinvent Nixon, and I'm probably guilty of this too, to reinvent Nixon in recent years as the last good Republican, or, man, we didn't realize how good things were under Nixon. So I think a real reinvention of Watergate or the early 70s. And I don't think Democrats today have really quite figured out how they want to interpret the Clinton years.
And I think what Tim is saying also suggests some of the kind of contentions around what is acceptable evidence, what are the responsibilities of historians and timelines to include contradictory evidence, what is the impulse, so to speak, how do we treat the impulse to derive some sort of a grand narrative, or even can we develop several narratives in a certain sense? So if a triumph of liberalism might be one, and we could also take the flip side of that in some way or another. And can we still reconcile them in some sense for kind of more synoptic sort of history?
It's really difficult. I mean, I think one of the big problems in American politics today is people just have such different narratives about things. And obviously the split between Fox News and MSNBC and, you know, stuff like Media Matters, more legitimate news outlets, that I think provide a more objective picture of things. It's just so difficult because people get trained with these usually different views of history. And I think on both sides, I think the right's probably more guilty of this with some of the way it treats history, but this tendency to say that United States history is monodirectional and it has to be progressing in a certain way, and that certain periods were just, you know, illegitimate or just didn't happen, period, a willful attempt to forget that they did take place. And so I think it's really hard. I mean, you gotta find a way to implement a more thoughtful, a more subtle, and the kind of view of history and a view of chronology in American history that allows for different directions rather than just saying everything is tending towards a utopia of no taxes or, you know, welfare for everybody or so on.
And, Tim, I certainly agree with you. And perhaps to just move away from politics slightly, I think this does kind of light on one reason why people should eventually read this book as an example of creative scholarship and historical inquiry, where I believe Rosenberg and Grafton probably surprised themselves a little bit writing this book in terms of where exactly the case studies and the different timelines themselves and the evidence all kind of came together, and how in some sense, like with all good history, it probably competed with the authors for some sort of a control. There isn't a single narrative, really, maybe past that Priestley chart in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I very much agree. I mean, I think we both felt that the book, I mean, you know, maybe to bring this sort of full circle or connect different themes, I think we felt like the book lost a certain coherency that we were expecting past the Priestley chapter as we went to the frontier, as we looked at 19th century technologies and those and their impact on the timeline and so on. But, you know, maybe we should, you know, learn from what we were just talking about, monodirectionality, and just appreciating that it didn't, you know, past a certain point, it just got so complicated. And people use timelines for wildly different purposes today. So maybe the real lesson is this early 1700s is the last moment of a truly unified conception of how you could formally depict time. And since then, certainly we found plenty of evil ways or deceptive ways to depict the passage of time in history, but we've also developed a lot of really creative ways to do so, and we should celebrate that too.
Well, thank you, Tim. I think this has been a really wonderful conversation. I would love to continue talking with you about, say, Spengler, say, the use of timelines in microhistory, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've hopefully kind of whet everybody's appetite to actually just take a peek at this book.
Yeah, we really recommend it. And again, the book's title is Cartographies of Time, A History of the Timeline. And the authors are Daniel Rosenberg and Anthony Grafton. So, yeah, thanks for listening. And for now, we're going to sign off with that. So, until the next podcast.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to The Historical Gadfly. Again, I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, of the University of Oxford. If you have any questions, suggestions, or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch with us at historicalgadfly@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.